Thought about it. He's got a swing over, and he's going to go back to his dump instead. Works this one up. Jeff Babbitt, layout D. How about that for a debut? Jeff.
Welcome back. We are all wrapped up with week one of the 2024 UFA season, and we have some big headlines to get to, starting with the reigning MVP, Jeff Babbitt's debut up in Boston. Glory coming away with a big win at home in that one. Elsewhere, New York extends their winning streak to a UFA record 31 games in their home opener on Saturday night. Salt Lake coming away with a big 3-goal win as they held off DC Breeze in the inaugural game of the UFA's Super Series. Carolina getting a surprising 8-goal win at home against Atlanta as they make one of the most impressive starts to their season. Cam, we have so much to get to in this episode. I don't want to keep you on the sideline for too long. We've got the first, I feel like, real episode of Swing Pass of 2024. We've just been building up to this point. Now we've got games. Now we've got analysis. Now we've got a real bunch of stuff to talk about. Where do you want to start? What are your kind of impressions? This is your now 13th year in the league. You've got a lot to say. You've got a lot of perspective. What are you coming away with? New disc, new opportunities. There's so much. Where are you taking away?
I honestly, the thing that caught my eye this week and the most had to be that Carolina-Atlanta game. Carolina just coming out and just reminding everyone of what they're capable of. Some of their new pieces looking really sharp. Some guys returning to the lineup after taking a year or so off, coming back and making big impacts. It was just really impressive to see not that just that they won, but just how dominant they were in their performance against an Atlanta team that was clearly the best team during the regular season in the South Division last year. And the thing that really jumped out to me wasn't it wasn't a start to finish domination by Carolina. But as we talked in the pre-show, it was the adjustments that they seemed to make throughout the game, because Atlanta was up 7-6 in this game. It wasn't like Atlanta was behind from the get-go. They were up 4-2 with 4 minutes left in the first, up 7-6. And then Carolina just flipped a switch and Atlanta just couldn't keep up with them.
Yeah, I mean, to your point, Atlanta looked like the class of the South last year. They finished with 10 regular season wins. They host the South Division title game. But it kind of feels like the effects of that championship game loss in their division to Austin and that double OT finish is still kind of lingering into this year, because this was just not the same hustle team that we grew accustomed to last year, both in terms of, I think, personnel, but also just in terms of style and play. Again, Atlanta won the season series 3-1, kind of going away against Carolina. And after the first couple of minutes, there was no real sense that the hustle could make much of an impact on this team, especially offensively with the way that that Flyers defense is playing. And we'll definitely get to that, I think, a little bit later on in the episodes as we get into more analysis of these games. I kind of wanted to start off with what felt like the pinnacle matchup of the weekend, the Super Series tilt between DC and Salt Lake. And I thought it was a really interesting game. I felt like both teams came in with it being a first ever matchup for both the Shred and the Breeze with a little bit of trepidation around just feeling out the matchup. It felt like neither team really got into their particular style too quickly. Felt like DC took about a quarter and a half to really get in some of the more possession-based drives built around Andrew Roy, Gus Norbaum, and that backfield. Also, Thomas Edmonds playing an offense to start the season for the Breeze looked excellent in his offensive role. But as a whole, the Breeze just kind of felt a little bit different, a little bit not quite as pristine, right? We've talked about this system with the Breeze offense being kind of a machine. And if anything is lagging a little bit, a lot can kind of start to go sideways. And it felt like some combination of new disc, new season, new coach, new lineups, new opponent, new atmosphere just sort of threw the whole thing off. What was your impression with DC in their 3-goal loss? And then we can flip it over to what Salt Lake did well in the win.
Yeah, for me, DC, when they fell behind early, they got down 2 really early, and it just kind of felt like they were playing from behind the whole game, and they never were able to like make up that gap. even when they made it close, I think they got it to within one goal a couple of times. It's like right when they did, and it kind of seemed like maybe they'd get some momentum back. Salt Lake just kind of ratcheted up and I think extended the lead to five at some point. The same thing that plagued their offense last year continued to plague their offense early. They still aren't good throwing in the deep space. They had a number of deep throws that were either too far or too floaty and ended up becoming contested. And that just continues to be kind of a thorn in the side of their offense. Thomas Edmonds looked great, you know, shocker, who would have known a player of his caliber would have looked great playing offense. I think he led the team in plus minus, if I remember correctly. Andrew Roy still doing his thing, moving the disc around, seemingly making all the right decisions, always going to make the next pass, the right path. It's always going to be completed, but ultimately.
I'll just say to that.
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to interrupt to say about Andrew Roy, what really, I think, stuck in the head about, oh, this is going to be kind of a weird night for DC's offense was the very first point, he just bricked a swing pass, just dropped it. I mean, I don't know that he's done that in the past, like, season and a half. We've talked about it extensively on the show. He's one of the most reliable pivot handlers, and there was just, I don't know, like, there was just a couple of mistakes for DC, particularly, like, in their reset passes and some of their swings that was so un-Breeze-like, given what we're accustomed to seeing from a team that finishes perennially within the top two of this league in, like, offensive efficiency, team completion percentage, red zone efficiency. I mean, that was kind of one of the glaring things about this game that stood out to me for both squads. Breeze and Shred were number one and number two, respectively, in red zone efficiency last year at 86.8% for DC, 85.3% for Salt Lake. In this game, neither team above 79%. Both teams squandering a few mistakes, and it just makes me think back to, of course, reigning coach of the year Bryce Merrill anticipated all of this when he spoke to Evan Leffler last week in a WatchUFA.com article about how, yeah, the disc is different, and particularly in the red zone, we're noticing its effects. Merrill referenced how much their offense likes to kind of allow Jordan Kerr to find a mid-level target range for Jace Dunabal to go into and how they've been struggling to do that in practice. And I thought that was very apparent on Saturday night in this game. Both teams, for being so polished in that area, just struggled to get it going. DC had a couple of just mistakes on the goal line that cost them really crucial scores, particularly in the second half. Isaac Lee got a great against-the-grain layout block, and DC squandered it on just a lazy reset throw a couple throws later.
Yeah, and I mean, when you look at it, there were eight drops in this game, four from each team, and like, that's not a new disc problem. That's just not looking the disc in and not catching it, not making sure that you have control of it. And I that was kind of a storyline across a lot of the games I watched. It seemed to be an increase in drops, and I don't know if it's first week jitters. I don't know what the reasoning for that is, but that seemed to be an issue for whatever reason, because a lot of these drops, it wasn't like they were contested. I mean, a lot of these were in players' guts. Like, you couldn't put it in a better spot, and people were just taking their eyes off the disc, maybe feeling the pressure of the moment in that first game. I really felt like DC's D-line really let them down in this game, though. When they got the disc, they just did not value it. In fact, I believe there were back-to-back D-line possessions that when they got them were, I think one of them was an A.J. Merriman huck that was nowhere near anyone, followed by another one that would have been a turnover had a timeout not been called. And it just kind of seemed like the D.C. D-line, as patient as their offense is and as many throws as they're willing to take, it kind of seemed like the D-line had the opposite mantra in that Salt Lake game. It was almost frantic, and like they had to, almost like what you see from the Minnesota Windchill counterattack, where it's like, hey, we're going to try to score in three throws or less. And it's just like, that. Why do that? Like, they have so much talent on the defensive side of the disc. They can work that disc. They can take their time getting upfield. And it just felt like they weren't playing with that kind of game plan in mind. I'd be curious to know if that's a coaching decision. Are they trying to push the disc down the field faster? Because it certainly looked intentional, but it clearly did not pay off for them, as I think what they were 3 for 10. On break opportunities, in their D-line conversion percentage, excuse me. So having 10 possessions, only punching in three. Meanwhile, Salt Lake wasn't stellar either. They were only 6 for 12 on conversion percentage, but that 50% is a lot better than 30%. So also a couple. 50
is kind of like the clearing mark.
Yeah.
50% on defensive efficiency is kind of the clearing mark for me. It's not great, but if you're converting 50% of your break opportunities, you will put yourself in a winning position most, if not all games.
Yeah.
You know, obviously it's not what Carolina did. We'll talk about that in a second, but yeah, I mean, I think to your point, the scoring gap literally skews out to the exact differences in break scores for this, you know, and almost the efficiencies themselves, 30% for DC, 50% for Salt Lake. That is the gap in the game. And it's funny because I think aesthetically, and now we can kind of flip over to Salt Lake's side, it felt like a bigger victory. I think DC got a few late scores when Shred were just looking a little preemptively celebratory in their home opener. You know, as you said, the lead had crept up to 5 or 6 goals at some point late in the fourth, and DC then kind of shortened it back to within 3 by the end. But to that point, it felt like a very clear victory for the Shred throughout most points in this game. It felt like there were opportunities for the Breeze to remain competitive. And I kind of wanted to stew a little bit there because, again, it's a good victory for the Shred. They handle business. But DC was down some people, and it felt like it could have been an even more authoritative victory for the home team. I mean, they had some really impressive performances, I think, starting with obviously Will Selfridge and Jordan Kerr. Selfridge just kind of taking over down the stretch, getting a whole bunch of contested goals, finishing with game highs and total scores, total yards, and I think just bodacious amounts of energy. And then Kerr, he's just settled into, I think, this zone with this team where he is so comfortable executing in any type of role that he produces stat lines like this. I mean, this is one of the most complete games you can have. 4 assists, 2 goals, a block, which was a hand block on a double team late in the fourth quarter when the Breeze were trying to get back into it. 20 of 20 from the field, 0 turnovers, and 380 total yards. Just crisp as can be. Fresh laundry from that guy. And then, don't look now, but year 2 Grant Lindsley is sort of becoming in a similar vein where he's just not overextending himself. He's kind of being available in the ways that Grant Lindsley has been excellent throughout his career on any offensive system. And he finishes with 2 assists, 2 goals, a block, 45 of 47 from the field, 500 total yards. And it's just, when you have Selfridge, Kerr, and Lindsley putting up numbers like that, Salt Lake's hard to beat. And yet, it was kind of only 3 goals, you know? Like, I don't know. There was something about it where it felt like Shred had a little bit more opportunity to capitalize on.
Yeah, I think Salt, this was a game that felt not as close as the final score, like, tells us that it was. It felt like Salt Lake was in control. When Salt Lake made a mistake, it seemed like an error of, like, maybe an error of execution. When DC made a mistake, it kind of felt like mental lapses of like, why are you making this throw? Why was that the decision? You know, you had, I feel like this almost perfectly encapsulates like what I saw from DC. There was a sequence where Cole Jurek got a D that was called back on a foul. He ends up getting the D shortly after that on that same point and then drops the disc. As he comes in for an in, kind of jumping up, grab it high, but like you have to make that catch. Like that's not a spectacular catch. That's something that everyone at this level should be making. But that's kind of the way this game seemed to me. It's like anytime DC did something where it looks like they were going to close the gap, they would find a way to squander it. Like usually in that same point. And Salt Lake, when they made mistakes, it looked like they were finding ways to make up for them, and that they were going to like right their wrong.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you there. It felt more of like you were saying, lack of execution on Salt Lake's side, where some uncharacteristic and a handful of mistakes for the Breeze on the other, where it was just stuff you're not used to seeing from them. And again, just maybe road game, first game, different lineups. There was underratedly, I think, almost amount of changes for DC. They lost basically their entire starting defense from last year, and going on the road against the number one offense from 2023 and the league runner up, it's just a big task. And I thought maybe the takeaway for DC is they still kept it competitive. There were still moments in the final 2 minutes where Salt Lake was all of a sudden very aware that the gap was closing. And if they kind of made a couple of more head-scratching turnovers and DC capitalized right on their own goal line, they would be in some trouble. But, you know. And then on the flip side, just two more takeaways for Salt Lake. Rookie Ben Field, who is on offense, I think in lieu of Elijah Jaime, not being available in this, and Joe Merrill actually being on defense in his first game back for the Shred. Field and like the Selfridge connection downfield, that looks really special for the Shred offense. That looks like a complete X factor, as either Alex Atkins or Ian Toner described on the broadcast. Field has a hand cannon. Like the dish just comes out of it and it is on a rope downfield, and combined with Selfridge's speed, that's going to be something to watch for in the West. And then I was texting you about a couple other people, and it finally just broke through. I've been waiting to feel a Will Selfridge comparison that made sense. Something about the hair and the speed this weekend did it for me. Young Jay Froude, man. He's got a little bit of that Young Jay Froude in him. Just the playmaking, the unbridled excitement at running away from people whenever he wants to. It's very, very Froudian, man. It's very... the electric playmaker can take your team to a different level by just getting into his own. And I think you saw that with Selfridge again. And again, he's barely a year and a half out from like a catastrophic knee injury, two ligaments exploding at high school nationals in 2022. And he's looking like one of the best young players in the league.
Everyone should just listen to me about who to play on offense. I mean, I said this back in January. Thomas Edmonds is to be playing offense. Will Selfridge is to be playing offense. Don't you dare sub them out for somebody else. And hey, what do you know? They both looked really great this weekend. I mean, some things I feel like sometimes people are too close to the situation. They can't see the forest for the trees. But I know you and I both have been in agreement on this. Like, those two people need to be playing offense full time. Like, they do not need to be moving people in and out and, you know, moving Will Selfridge to D-line. I think like what we saw in this first game, if it wasn't already cemented in your brain, like, this kid is special. Like, the fact that, like you said, doing this, not only coming back from an injury, but he's so young. Like, there's no way we're seeing anywhere close to what his like potential is, right? Like, he has so much more ultimate left to play. He's incredibly young. He's incredibly coachable from everything I hear too. Works his butt off. Like, his teammates love him. You know, texting with you said, like, a lot of his teammates think, like, he's the best player on the team. Although
it's the not-so-quiet secret of anyone you ask in, like, Utah Ultimate in general is that, like, Selfridge is the truth. That everyone's kind of, like, waiting for him to kind of, like, fully assume it. Like, but you see it. You see it so clearly in moments like this weekend where he just starts taking over for stretches. Doing the bus driver on everyone. I mean, it's just... a little infectious, to be honest.
He's definitely practiced his celebrations. He brought out a bunch of them very quickly. These are things he's,
I don't know, man,
he's thought about.
He gets a little spazzy on some of them. Some of them still need to go back in the oven a little bit, but I hear you. One final note on this game. Rowan and Johnny Malk's 7 combined throwaways. That's tough. Moving on, though, let's talk about the game of the week. Big 8-goal win for Carolina over Atlanta at home. We talked about it briefly earlier. Just wanted to go through a few of the kind of narrative elements of this game. Atlanta started off with a 4-2 advantage with 4:18 to go in quarter one. From that point forward, 11-4 run for Carolina to close out the half. In the game, Carolina's defense, you mentioned it earlier, 11 of 13 on breaks, 83%. Against one of the top 4 most efficient offenses from last season. Just to get a little bit deeper into the numbers, the 46% offensive efficiency rating for Atlanta, lowest since August 14th of 2021, nearly 3 years ago. Carolina, ton of credit to their defense, especially just, I think, schematically. They were able to pin the Atlanta defense on so many, or excuse me, Atlanta offense on so many possessions against their back line. Hustle had a really tough time fielding pulls from a very unlikely source. Henry Fisher, who played in, I think, 2 games last year, and we're used to seeing score like 40 goals a season on offense. They've redeployed him on defense as this pulling specialist, and he has been phenomenal. I mean, we've seen him developing as a very good, I think, deep thrower in selective spots for the past few years. But I didn't know he quite had the pulling turn in him. But he was just hamstringing a lot of these hustle drives to begin with, because they'd have to work so far to even get up to like the 10-yard line on the field. But Carolina only finished with 8 blocks in this game. Atlanta as a team, too, finished with sub 20 turnovers, which is still a pretty good number. But when you're giving up 11 break scores and 11 of 13 overall, you're not gonna win that game. For Carolina's side, offensively, it was the debut game after missing 2 full seasons for the 2021 All UFA member Alan Laviolette. He looked phenomenal. He looked like he did not lose a step. He finished with 6 assists, 2 goals, a block, 35 of 36 from the field, and a team-high 438 total yards. Again, it was his first game since the 2021 championship when Carolina knocked off New York, the last time the Empire lost a game. And then final note for Carolina, Elijah Long and Alexander Wilcox are the new backfield for this Flyers offense. And they looked like the Yannick and MGH of old a little bit, at least as far as the box score goes. Combined, Wilcox and Long were 96 of 98 total on their throws. 3 assists, 3 goals, 5 hockey assists, and just keeping everything moving, everything up into that continuation space, allowing Laviolette and Fairfax and Jungs to do a whole bunch of the heavy hitting downfield. I was saying this to a few people, Carolina felt 2 levels above almost any other competition this weekend, reigning champions from New York included. They looked sharp against Atlanta.
Yeah, and you know, I want to go back to what you said about the polls. Like, the polls seem to make such a huge difference in this game, and like that,
a lot of games.
Well, that's fair. And this game in particular, like you want to go see Atlanta's offensive struggles. It all starts from the time the poll goes up. It's starting immediately, and I mean, to me, that's coaching. Like, you have not spent enough time on something that needs to be a priority in this league. As we saw last year, how much better defense has got, how many more breaks they were getting, how many more Callahans there were. And it just seems like if you didn't know coming into the season, especially with the way this disc flies, like, it is easier to pin people deep with this disc. It just, the way it flies further, it flies more true. That should have been a priority for every team in this offseason. And like, I think you can tell watching the games which teams prioritize figuring out how they were going to field polls and which teams didn't. And that was a huge storyline for me across pretty much every game. Like you said, I mean, you talked about Rowan and Malks and, you know, 7 combined throwaways. Austin Taylor, Bobby Lay, Christian Olsen combined for 7 throwaways. You cannot have that from those guys. Those are very uncharacteristic numbers. I think we were talking in the pre-show, it was so obvious how much Atlanta missed Matt Smith and Max Thorn.
The biggest absences of the weekend, I think, in, as far as just the results and you looking 100%. At what happened.
And I think what people don't realize, like, a lot of people who don't pay close attention or like haven't seen these players in person, I think in particular with Matt Smith, people might look at the statistics and say, oh, hey, like, this guy scores lots of goals. So like, clearly that's his contribution, but it's not really that. The thing that Matt Smith does so well is just being available all the time. Like, if you need a pressure release, you just need to have somebody open in the middle of the field to move the disc. Matt Smith's as good at doing that as anybody in the league. And the thing he does so well after catching it is releasing it quickly so that they can continue to move the disc. And that was just missing. They were missing that person who was just going to be available and able to help move the disc quickly. And you just saw it on a number of opportunities where Bobby Lay or Austin Taylor's picking up the disc and the rest of it, it's like they're just trying to rely on them to make great throws to people instead of just having this easy chisel option that they can like then bounce the disc to the other side of the field.
Well, and that was what was so impressive about Atlanta's offense last season, when it arguably performed better than it ever has before. There's always been this long ball element to the ATL scene, right? Like, it's pronounced in their history across sports, right? Like, Atlanta loves the long ball, literally goes back to the early 90s and the Braves. But like, this hustle team has embodied it too. They've been the most efficient and high volume hucking team in the league since we started keeping track of stats in 2021. Bobby Lay and Austin Draco Taylor were the most volume hucking tandem in the league last year as teammates. And yet, this game, they were missing that middle layer of Matt Smith and Max Thorne, the latter of whom won't be on the team this year. And whether it was the personnel absences from the O-line itself or Carolina's ability as a defense to take it away, you just see, you know, we talk about layers, I think, a lot of times in the field. You kind of have first, middle, second, or third, you know, or short, mid, and deep, I think, a lot of times. And you kind of talk about the ability, I think, for offenses to get versatile between those spaces, to connect them. Whereas for a defense, you're trying to disconnect those elements. And I think one of the things we've seen so effective for this Carolina defense that, again, doesn't produce tons of takeaways, doesn't get an inordinate amount of blocks, they're really good at separating your handler movement from what you're trying to do downfield. They don't let you get much into continuation spaces unless you're kind of getting a little hectic. And that's where Atlanta was on Saturday. They were either in the backfield or they were blitzing to get Haden Austin-Knabb or Bobby Lay or Austin Taylor into power position, and then it was go, 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 downfield, let's attack. But there was no calm down. There was no middle layer. There was no Matt Smith. There was just attack, attack, attack. Again, like, they had a 4-2 lead. They were looking pretty comfortable, but they couldn't settle on any easy possessions. And so it just completely flipped in the middle portion of this game. And again, like, that's so converse to how they played Carolina last year, where it felt like they were downright boring in their attack of the Flyers defense a lot of times. They would just kind of run the ball down your throat, so to speak, the length of the field. And I felt like they could not do that on Saturday. They didn't have that in their system.
As concerning as the offense was after, you know, they were up 7-6 and they just kind of fell apart for the rest of the game, what's really more concerning to me is how little resistance they put up after a turn. I mean, Carolina was 11 for 13 on their D-line conversion. I mean,
that, can we talk about that D-line though? That D-line got bolstered because we talked about Elijah Long and Alexander Wilcox taking over the offensive throwing backfield responsibilities. They've now shifted Saul Yannick back to his more natural defensive position. Trevor Lynch is back over on defense as well. He finished as like a 50-goal scorer, completing 95% of his throws, averaging almost 400 yards a game for the offense last year. He's now on defense. They have firepower on that defense, man. I think New York is still the best team as far as kind of slingshotting and really getting into that. You mentioned Minnesota about just kind of like three throws and we're in the end zone. Carolina likes that too now. I mean, and they've got a lot of talent on that side of this. Cooper Williams was making plays for them. Like, that Carolina defense is something to watch out for this year.
And it is hard, right? Like, I'll give Atlanta some credit. Like, when you have two guys who have played a lot of offense over the last few seasons, I mean, Saul Yannick was on the O-line when they won in 2021, right? When they won the championship. He was on the O-line in 2022 when we thought that they might be able to give New York a run for their money at championship weekend. Spoiler alert, we were really wrong. But I get that. But you can't give up 11 out of 13 break opportunities. You just can't do it. Like, that just shows a lack of urgency for me defensively after a turn. Like, I don't, you have to find ways to manufacture Ds. You have to find ways to hold them at least closer to like a 60%. 85% is just insane.
Yeah. Let's move on and take a step back and get more to a complete scoreboard picture of the weekend that was. Again, we mentioned at top of the show, Boston getting a big win at home behind another just MVP level performance from Jeff Babbitt. He gets two blocks in his first point with the team, finishes with five on the night, tying teammate Chris Bartoli for the game high. He has three goals, zero turnovers, also had the kind of emphatic play of the fourth quarter, getting a run through block and an under that made Boston able to push their lead to two, which ended up being the dagger in the game. Again, Glory now starting the season 1-0 and just looking like a different beast this year. I still think it's very apparent from their opening performance that there's a lot to work through. These are a lot of players who have clearly not spent a ton of time this offseason, given the amount of recent signings the past few weeks. But man, the talent's there. The talent's there. Babbitt's out there running around getting front cone scores. He's got natural connections with Ben Sadoque from their college days. That defense is large. Tanner Johnson Goh is a playmaker who, when you forget about him, he can just start to take over for stretches as both a thrower and a receiver. Tyler Chan is super fast. Like, there's a lot to like here, and they were still absent a couple of their biggest playmakers. Big win for Boston. Elsewhere, Minnesota starting off strong on the road, getting an 18-11 win over Pittsburgh. Houston collecting, I think, one of the more exciting wins of the opening weekend, 26-21 over Interstate Dallas. Ben Lewis going absolutely supernova in that game. We'll talk about him in a minute. But really impressive, I think, year two opening performance from Houston. That speed that we were hearing about coming into this year, I think, is real. They have a lot of people who can just sort of push and pressure you on the field, as well as I think their year two players really stepping up into bigger positions in their roles. You talk about Ben Lewis, Matt Bennett, Mark Balduff, Brendan Adams, Connor Ogeda, kind of the leadership and veteran class of this team. All had really statement performances, I thought, in the win. Again, just a good footing to start on for Houston as they enter their second season. New York, of course, getting their 31st win in a row, 18-16 over Montreal. Seattle, haven't mentioned Seattle yet. Need to mention Seattle. Seattle, Donnybrooking Seattle on Saturday, 28-14 at home. And if you watch this game, it was basically a blueprint victory for this new Seattle squad. They get an opening score on a Khalif El-Salam huck to Zeppelin Ronig in the first 20 seconds of the game clock. Lucas Ambrose gets a block in his first quarter, and then, again, they just run away from Seattle at home. San Diego did get back on track the next day, got a win on the road, 23-16 at Portland. And then elsewhere in the West Division, we had a battle of SoCal between Oakland and LA. Oakland coming out on top, 20-17 in their home opener, but there were 50 combined turns from both teams in this game. Not exactly the cleanest ultimate. Lot of, I think, emotionality present in this game, given how these two teams played out in the last few weeks of the regular season last year. Where do you want to start in all this chaos of just sort of scoreboard running? What big impressions did you have taking away from week one, just kind of across the board?
There were really two storylines that kind of like stuck out to me across the rest of those games. We'll start with Montreal. Montreal, we knew was going to be better than last year, but we weren't really sure to what extent they would be better than last year. And I think they came out and proved right off the bat that they are going to be a force to be reckoned with. In both of these games, that they started to kind of get away from them in like the third quarter, and you kind of thought, oh, this is where Boston or this is where New York just kind of runs away with it and this game doesn't look close. But quite the opposite happened. It was like once they kind of hit that death valley, like that lowest point in the game, they like rebounded and got these games within two, in the Boston game within one, as you mentioned, Babbitt getting the run through D when Montreal was actually attempting to break to tie the game. And that was super impressive to me. The other thing, Toby DeCrane is insane. That guy comes over, first two games in the UFA, seems like he's been there forever, just like the best player on the field at certain points during both games. I would argue in the New York game, he was the best player on the field throughout the game. And if it wasn't for Jeff Babbitt, you know, kind of picking his spots and doing some Jeff Babbitt things and just beating people to front cones and racking up Ds, I would say that he may have just been the best player in that game as well. But he came in, he was an immediate difference maker. I can't wait to see what he does throughout the rest of the season, because not only was he a difference maker in terms of just like, I feel like not just the ability, but the confidence that he was able to bring to the team, but he had some moments where he made some ill-advised throws and did some things that I expect him to kind of work out throughout the season. And even despite those things, he still was the best player in the field, like throughout so much of both of those games, and exciting, making layout grabs, you know, pinpoint hucks across the field, around big marks. It just didn't seem to matter. He was unfazed and he was terrific all weekend.
That man brought a Mary Poppins bag into this league. And I was telling his teammate, Kevin Quinlan, that was one of the top 3 to 5 most impressive debuts I've ever seen on the pro scene. Both games, let alone stacking them together. I mean, it took him about 2 quarters to warm up in Boston, but he was just taking over for stretches in the back half of that game. The reason why Montreal got back into it was because their defense was pesky. I really liked how Royale played defensively the entire weekend. They weren't doing anything crazy or laying out all over the place. It wasn't like the Shred coming into the season in 2022 and just getting layout blocks on people, or Lucas Ambrose last season for LA or something like that. It was just kind of, they played close, they marked up well, and they took advantage of the opportunities when they presented themselves in a week one where there was a lot of sloppy play. And man, when Ducrane just started getting into the zone, and the thing is, his zone is, he's arguably the most athletic guy in the field, but he was uncorking some Quinlan throws as forehands, especially against New York. In addition to probably the highlights playing over my voice talking right now, the aesthetic quality of how he played, let's do some number diving here. Against Boston on Friday night, this is his pro debut. 4 assists, 3 goals, a block, 29 of 31 from the field, +6 overall, again, in a 2-goal loss, and a game high for both teams, 614 total yards. Next night, he commits a few more turnovers. He's 31 of 35 from the field, but they're trying to, I think, just be a little bit more aggressive against the New York defense, knowing they can't just like sit home and let, essentially getting coverage sacks against the terrific Empire Handler defensive line. So Ducrane took a few more shots downfield, but here's the results. Game high, 6 assists, double the next highest player in this game, 2 goals, 4 blocks. He got 4 blocks, tied his teammate Christophe Tremblay-Jonkoff for game high. 31 of 35 from the field. Again, he had 4 turnovers. He still finished +9. Most of anyone on the game. Also game high, 601 total yards. So for the weekend in 2 games, never played in this league before, 10 assists, 5 goals, 5 blocks, 60 completions, 1,200 total yards. It's pretty good.
Pretty good. And, you know, like, it wasn't just him. Like, there were lots of contributions across the board. I thought Kevin Quinlan, you know, my brother, the only other guy who's played every year, right? He had some throws this weekend. I think that just kind of, we forget how talented of a thrower he is. Like, he had some big throws this weekend. He's kind of got every throw in the bag. Quentin Bonneau coming back, like he never left, like scoring goals left and right. That he had that huge grab in the New York game where he had 2 defenders draping him, and it was almost like he did some sort of Houdini magic trick, because when I was watching, I was like, oh, that got D'd. And all of a sudden, he's just like walking out of that group of 3 guys with the disc in his hand. And I'm like, I should have known better. Why did I ever doubt that he was going to come down with that disc? And, you know, they did this without Jacob Brissett, who is, we would think, would be one of the really high contributing players in this team. He's a terrific thrower. He wasn't there this weekend. So I'm even more curious to see, add him in. I think the coaching staff of Montreal is probably kicking themselves on that run through Babbitt D you mentioned. They did have a timeout to burn, and I feel like in that situation, that late in the game, you have a chance to tie the game. You have to call that timeout, get your offense on the field. They'd already run off some breaks, and it's just kind of like, that seemed the time to call that timeout. I'm sure they're kicking themselves, but very impressive from a team that really was non-competitive last year to come in against 2 teams that we expect to be, you know, 2 of the better teams in this division. This division's crazy. Like, I have no clue what's going to happen, but I'm really excited. One more good team that could potentially push for playoffs.
Yeah, Royale is going to be a monkey wrench in somebody's machine this year, and I think both Boston and New York are kind of wiping away their brow, having gotten them in week one, and not necessarily, although they're going to have to both face them in Montreal, where Montreal has been a different beast at home for many, many years. We've known this many times. And again, Montreal was the last team to beat New York at New York. It was way back in 2018, but it did happen. So we've covered Montreal. Ben Lewis wanted to touch on him in the Houston win. He had another just, maybe we should have put him on our top 25 selections at the end of last week. Lewis finished with 4 assists, 9 goals, 3 blocks, 670 total yards, and just looking like a completely evolved version of an already great player that played on some championship quality teams with Dallas for several years. Lewis has just continued to round out his game over the past season plus with Houston. He's now a very serviceable thrower in the continuation game, and just his confidence. He was just running around out there like a madman. I mean, he was kind of playing can you catch me at certain points in that game against the Dallas defense and just looked unstoppable. So I don't know where Houston's ceiling necessarily ends up, but they look like they've got some pop this season that they did not have last year. And it looks like their roles are a little bit more refined. Another player I forgot to mention in their veteran lineup who had a really solid performance, Jimmy Zura, who is, I think, a thrower to watch this season, could put up some really crazy numbers as they look a little bit more, I think, role specialized this year. Houston last year just kind of played it in everywhere. And then last point, Seattle. In addition to it being a 14-goal win at home, man, this team just looked different. Shane Worthington, coming back to the team, talked in an interview last week about how the Cascades have sort of shifted their mentality from not trying to lose as many games as possible each year to now wanting to go out and win in matchups. And that was very apparent in this week one win. That was so apparent. But all that aside, I wanted to get to in our last few moments, what we had talked about heading into this episode, real or overreaction. This is where we just kind of go over a couple of topics real quick and talk about whether what we're seeing will be felt throughout the 2024 season or whether we might just be experiencing some opening weekend overreactions. So I'll place it to you, Cam. Real or overreaction? New York, and specifically their offense, that they had to, break in case of emergency, shift over John Randolph from defense in order to stymie off this Montreal comeback. Is New York, and in particular their offense, in trouble? Are they maybe a little bit more of a liability than we initially conceived of?
I'm going to say real. This was a team that was actually pretty patient with the disc in the past. Like, they actually averaged, I believe, the most or second most throws per goal scored when receiving the disc last year. I don't think that they can really rely on that quite the same way, losing Lithiau, Babbitt, and Osgar all in the same season. They need to figure out a way how they need to run offense now, not how they ran it in the past. I'm going to say real.
Yeah, yeah. Real or overreaction, DC's struggles with defensive efficiency and converting breaks?
Again, I'm going to go real. They lost so many people off that defense last year. It looked like they were still able to force some turnovers, but when you look at the statistics, we also see that Salt Lake City had 4 drops, and those mostly were not due to defensive pressure. I think they're going to have trouble getting the disc. And they just looked so uncomfortable once they got it. I'm going to say real.
Real or overreaction, Montreal has 2 of the 6 best athletes in their division in Ducrane and Christophe Tremblay-Jonca, who was, I think, dominant defensively against Yacht and Deep Space on Saturday. Ben Yacht didn't have anything going against that truck and CTJ. I mean, as Kevin Quinlan said going into last year, they call that boy El Camion. Like, he's known north of the border, man. Like, Tremblay-Jonca is a big dude who can get downfield in a hurry.
This one's tough, right? Because I'm thinking about the athletes of that division. You've got, obviously, Jeff Babbitt. You got a guy like Randolph, Antoine Davis. I'm going to go
James Pollard.
Yeah, James Pollard. I'm going to go not real, and it has nothing to do with how great those guys are or not. It's just, this is a division just rife with athletes. So I'm going to say maybe one of them's in there. I don't know if I could say both are in the top 6, but they're definitely in the conversation.
All right. And then final one, real or overreaction, Atlanta is in trouble. Keep in mind, not only did they sustain an 8-goal loss this last weekend, they've got to host New York this coming Saturday in the second Super Series matchup. I think that's going to be a big game. Obviously, it was going into the season, but I think that's an even bigger game than we anticipated for both teams. But I'll ask it on the hustle inflection. Real or overreaction, Atlanta's in trouble to start the season and could seriously face an 0-2 hole.
I'm going to say overreaction. The 0-2 hole wouldn't be a death sentence for them, especially with one of those coming out of division. I do think they had a number of meaningful absences this weekend that they won't have continuously throughout the season. I mentioned earlier how big I thought Matt Smith not being there was, just for their offense having some pressure release. So I'm going to say it's overreaction, but come back to me in a week because I could change my tone, you know, when we see what they look like against New York. Because if there's a defense that's going to test them, it's going to be New York. So I think we'll have a really good idea after next week, but I'm not willing to give up on an offense yet that was so good just last year.
Yeah, No, I hear you. I see this Hustle team, and I see how much the intangible stuff kind of plays into them and their identity, and I wonder how it will affect them to face two defenses like Carolina and New York back-to-back and maybe not get their rhythm going. On the flip side of that, there was a team that started 0-2 in recent years and went on to win a championship, and that was the 2021 Carolina Flyers. So it's even been done within their own division. 0-2 is by no means a death sentence, but it certainly would be quite the inverse of, I think, where we expected the Hustle to start this year after last year's, again, 10-win regular season. But that'll do it for this week one recap episode of Swing Pass. We've got to wrap it up for now. We will be back in just a couple days, however, to preview week two as we really start to hit the ground running and get into our stride of the 2024 UFA regular season. We're a little bit shortened on this episode, but we'll have plenty to talk about in coming ones. Don't you go anywhere. We'll be talking soon. Bye for now.
This Atlanta Hustle team has been really impressive.
Super explosive team.
They're playing with a lot of confidence.
This team is going to work harder than they've ever worked before.
Playing the New York Empire is often a daunting task, but if there's a team that's up to it, Atlanta may be it.
Burnett closing the space.
Let him cook, Justin Burnett.
Yacht does it one more time against the Hustle.
Holzmeier. You can't stop him. You can only hope to contain
Antoine
him.
Antoine Davis has a score against his old team.
This New York franchise has redefined excellence.